This podcast is brought to you by In Remembrance of Me Communion Launcher. The COVID-19 pandemic is still going on, but let's face it, you've got to get back to church. Your worship service live stream keeps getting Zoom bombed by some kid in South Korea who thinks it's funny to put your pastor's face on the body of that Gangnam-style guy. Besides, your old people don't understand how to mute themselves on Zoom and keep complaining that it's too cold in the sanctuary, even though they're in their own homes. Even if half your congregation gets COVID, you've got to start up church again. One of the difficulties you may have encountered is how to serve communion safely. You can't have people come up to the altar rail. That's not social distancing. You can't pass the plates to people in the pews because you might pass the virus to one another. What's a sacrament-loving congregation to do? We have the answer. Introducing In Remembrance of Me Communion Launcher. You know when you go to sporting events and they have those t-shirt cannons capable of launching t-shirts into the upper decks? It's the same thing, but with communion. Using our patented technology, we will launch communion wafers directly into your church people's mouths. Your deacons will have loads of fun shooting the body of Christ into other people's bodies. When it comes to the blood of Christ, we have you covered too. Just think of a super soaker, but with your choice of grape juice or wine. Please note, gluten-free communion wafers are not available at this time. They tend to disintegrate upon launch, and anyway, we're pretty sure Jesus' death didn't really cover people with gluten allergies anyway. Don't give your church folks COVID-19 along with the body and the blood of Christ. Try In Remembrance of Me Communion Launcher today. Hello, Save Me Podcast listeners. I need to start off by apologizing for taking so long to get a new episode out. Originally, I had ambitions of getting one out every week, but it slowed down to every 10 days, then every 2 weeks. This time, it took three. I'll try to get back on the at least two-week schedule. I'm not really sure what the holdup is, but something is up with me internally in terms of energy. I guess I'm spending too much time listening to the wrong voices inside my head, and it's sapping my life force and creativity. I will try to do better and give the talking stick to some other voice in my head that's a little more positive. Hopefully, I'll get back to you sooner next time. Let's see, since I spoke with you last, I continue to fail as a minister. It's been a time of not bringing any more money and not bringing in more members, because money and members are the real numbers that determine success as a minister in our culture. I did not launch a viral sermon series that took a coronavirus-stricken nation by storm. I didn't do much more than the usual. And it's pretty difficult to know what counts as success when you're just doing the usual as a minister. I'll continue to shoot for being faithful, I guess. At least as faithful, the best way I know how to be. And I'll leave success to those who are more successful, according to American standards. How do I feel like American Christianity has declined in recent weeks? Well, first off, by offering meaningless prayers by a bunch of white folks, hoping that they will be considered nice instead of actually working for meaningful change and changing themselves, getting rid of their white privilege as much as that's possible, having some freaking empathy for black people. Sometimes I wonder if that's possible by white people in this country. American Christianity also declined because somehow it views taking down Confederate statues as messing with history, instead of understanding how history impacts the present for people who lack their skin color. American Christianity continues to decline because, well, it shrugged its collective shoulders at our racist, narcissist president because what he's up to only seems to really impact black and brown and poor people of all kinds and doesn't really impact the average middle-class white person. My favorite sign in recent weeks of the decline of American Christianity were the preachers going on Fox News vowing to defend their white Jesus statues from hordes of rampaging black people who, for some reason, don't think Christ the Liberator should look like Christ the Oppressor. A good sign that you have made your Jesus statue and your painting of white Jesus into a false idol is when you need to go on TV to defend it. I'm pretty sure if Jesus kept silent before Pontius Pilate, he would want you to keep your damn mouth shut before Tucker Carlson. I think that I could deal with American Christianity acting so awful if I still didn't feel so hurt by it and so disappointed by it. It's just all blasphemy. I guess that's yet another thing I need to be saved from. I've got my own self-righteous streak I need God to save me from. I've got my own lack of empathy I need God to save me from. I've got my own white privilege and my own blinders. I still need God to save me from that. And I need God to save me from the voices in my head that keep going round and round about what am I supposed to be doing with my life? Because I don't have any answers yet. One of the nice things about COVID-19 right now and working in a church is I am writing more, at least, and I'm sending out an email every day to church folks, most of whom I haven't even got a chance to meet yet. This interim gig I'm doing, sort of just sending it out to the void, hoping that something seems important and meaningful to me, seems important and meaningful to them. I have no idea, really, who's reading it and what they're getting out of it. But I am, I think, enjoying the writing. Well, something I've been doing lately is I've finally got around to watching the TV show on HBO, The Leftovers, and had it recommended to me by a number of folks because of the theological stuff in it, and I finally got around to watching it. So one day, I just wrote about it, and I thought that it would be worth sharing here. In my last episode, I shared more about my feelings as a white parent of black sons. Feedback I got from a non-church person was that he thought it was my best one yet because he said it was more relatable to folks who aren't really in church, and most of my stuff is about church. So I was going to share something about churchy stuff, and I thought I would share this instead, because maybe it's more relevant to more people. What I wrote is called We Are All Leftovers. For I am convinced that neither death nor life, nor angels nor rulers, nor things present nor things to come, nor powers nor height nor depth nor anything else in all creation will be able to separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus our Lord. And that's, of course, from Romans 8, 38 and 39. I'm not real sure why I'm emotional reading it right now. Maybe I feel separate from God. And so maybe it's good to hear. Crying, and I don't even know why. Anyway, here's what I wrote. During these days of pandemic quarantine, I've indulged in binging some TV series that have been on my list for a long time. Recently, I got around to watching the HBO series, The Leftovers. It's about what happens in a world where 2% of the world's population simply disappears one day. Poof. Suddenly, 140 million people are gone. People from every nation, ethnic group, gender, religion, sexuality, age, all simply gone. Those who have disappeared are called the departed. The show takes pains to show this is not some kind of rapture where the good people are taken off to heaven, because the departed were a mix of good and bad people. There is no explanation, no pattern, no sense to the world-changing event. It happened. And now the world must deal with that reality. The Leftovers was recommended to me by multiple people because of the show's overt religious subject and the many different ways characters both do and don't look to religion to make sense of their losses. One of the main characters is a minister, He's deeply flawed, but at least he is not a pedophile or an exorcist, which are the usual ways clergy show up in popular culture. Yet I had resisted watching the show, despite the recommendations, because one of its creators is Damon Lindelof. Lindelof also was a creator of the TV show Lost, which I watched, well, religiously back in the day. And I was sorely disappointed when the many mysteries the show set up were never answered in satisfactory ways. I didn't want to be frustrated and disappointed again. I became more open to Lindelof's leftovers when I read his statement early on declaring the show would never provide an answer to its central mystery, what happened to the missing people. Lindelof said the show isn't about answers, but about how people deal with not having answers to their deepest pain. Huh, that sounds like a pretty depressing show, but I'm interested, or at least interested enough to watch the show 6 years after it first came out. Indeed, Lindelof was true to his word. The Leftovers offers no definitive answers for why 140 million people simply vanished one day. Instead, the show is about how people deal with a grief that has no closure. Some double down on the religion they have. Others reject their former religions. Some create new religions, and there are new mysteries and seemingly supernatural events that end up raising more questions than they do answers. Some get lost in their work. Others quit their jobs. Some families grow closer. Others fall apart. Some self-medicate with drugs and alcohol. Others seek to drop all their vices. Conspiracy theories are everywhere, and some it seems a lot like real life when unexpected and or unexplained tragedy strikes. Whether it is 9/11 or a death in a car accident, a lost job, or a divorce, our losses set us adrift searching to make sense of what is nonsensical. Like somebody trying to put together a jigsaw puzzle without a picture on the box of the finished work. And for that matter, without all the pieces, we struggle to find a reason for our pain. It's no wonder people cling to shallow and dangerous theology like everything happens for a reason, or God just needed another angel in heaven, or God won't give you more than you can handle. Even bad theology is better than a world where nothing makes sense. A conspiracy theory, no matter how crazy, is preferable to a world where chaos can strike at any time. I've seen that people who work through their grief do so by creating meaning in their lives, in the way one might use a nail file to sculpt a mountain. And it happens slowly, with all sorts of stops and starts. It only happens with honesty, but even the most honest must deceive themselves sometimes, because the pain can be too much. I've learned in my own life and seen it also in my role as minister that more than answers, even though answers are important, people really want to know that they have not been rejected and abandoned by family and by friends and by God. And even when they and I push people away, inside we are begging for someone to stay beside us and help us bear our pain when it is too much for us to bear alone. Cards, letters, texts, emails, calls, visits, sitting down over coffee or a drink, talking, listening, crying, all matter more than explanations, because oftentimes there is no explanation good enough. At one time or another, all of us are leftovers, left behind as the world keeps spinning while we are stuck in our moments of pain. When that happens and I'm called to show up in my capacity as minister, if I mention God at all, I read the few verses in Romans 8 that declare nothing can separate us from the love of God. In the end, more than answers, that's all I want to know. If God can't show up in person, I will settle for a good friend. Many times I expect that is how God shows up anyway. My wife Jennifer says that all my sermons, and maybe everything I write, is really for nobody else but me. I didn't know when I wrote it that when I sat down to record it, I would need to hear those words. Maybe you do too. Just a reminder, folks, putting this podcast out in the world, and I've got no answers. So if you're looking for something on this podcast to save you, don't look at me. I'm looking for somebody to save me too. This podcast is also brought to you by Crokesbury Books Online Store. Are you a dying mainline church in need of transformation without your members having to sacrifice anything or change anything about the way they've done church for the last 75 years? Then Crokesbury Books is the online bookstore for you. Crokesbury offers the latest titles by the few pastors who lead growing megachurches in our mother denomination. Try one of their titles, like 10 Sermons I Recycled and Made into a Book by megachurch pastor Adam Williamson. Or how about this title by megachurch pastor Jimmy Massacre? Your church sucks, mine's better. Struggling with how to keep your church afloat during these trying times of social distancing, when you just don't know how to live stream your own worship service? Then how about James Bob O'Sneeze's latest bestseller, Just Give Up, I'm Waiting to Buy Your Church Building Anyway? You may be wondering, how long exactly can I keep my MAGA-loving members happy by sticking to parts of the Bible that don't sound liberal to them? Then Crokesbury Books is glad to offer you its brand new title, Jesus Isn't Political. His message was all about individual private religious preference. Never mind that stuff about caring for the least of these. He was just talking about charity. By Pentecostal powerhouse Paula Whitehouse. Order these books now at crokesbury.edu via our online Bible College bookstore website. We are glad to send you ebooks. If you are afraid of catching the coronavirus, from your UPS man, if it's a woman, then scream Jezebel at her as you throw stones. We can send you ebooks. By ebooks, we mean books our interns read out loud and we recorded, and then stuck inside a reprogrammed Teddy Ruxpin, wrapped inside Star Wars-themed R2-D2 bedsheets we found at a local thrift store. Try Crokesbury Books today. Okay, folks, I've recovered myself. Didn't know I was going to record myself having a breakdown. Instead of re-recording it, I just thought, what the heck, I'll put it out there. I'm not particularly sure why, but there you go. Anyway, on today's show, I'll have the second part of my interview with my friend Jeremy Rutledge, pastor of Circular Congregational Church in Charleston, South Carolina. We will talk about why his blatantly, utterly, unapologetically progressive church is flourishing in a red state against all odds. And then we'll skip ahead to where the conversation turns to Jeremy's own struggles with being a person with a compromised immune system during this particular pandemic. I'm glad to say that we will have another haiku from Sasquatch, the Right Reverend Aaron Rollerson, Father Aaron, serving the Episcopal Church of the Epiphany down in Alabama. And based on pictures I've been seeing of him lately on Facebook, he has got a good haircut and a little more coiffed. But I will always know him as Sasquatch because he's like 8 feet tall. And don't let the cleric scholar fool you. He is a hairy man. And we'll have another segment by Colleen Brown Only, one of the best writers I know. The segment that I call Married to the Minister. Don't forget to like the Save Me Podcast Facebook page. Follow us on Twitter. My handle is at SaveMePodcast1, the number one. You can listen and subscribe on iTunes and Spotify and a bunch of other platforms that I don't know the names of. You can always listen on my site at Anchor. If you'd like to support this podcast financially, I'd encourage you first to give your money to somebody working for racial justice. And then if you have some left over, you can sponsor the show by going to anchor.com/save-me-podcast and clicking sponsor. I'm going to have to do something nice for my current sponsors. I have heard on other podcasts that they do such things. So Ursel, Beth, Ruth, Jeff, and my anonymous benefactors, I'm thinking about that. I'll send something your way sometime. Most of you all can share this podcast with anybody else that you think can handle it. Just be warned, I'm an acquired taste, so this podcast isn't for everyone. Be careful, but recommend as you will. Also, please rate and review this podcast on your podcast platform. Apparently, that helps people find this podcast. I've decided that, yeah, I do want people to find it. It helps me feel like what I'm throwing out into the universe matters to somebody else. And so it really does make me feel less alone. So Junebug987, who wrote on iTunes, "The Reverend has something that needs saying. I look forward to every podcast. You won't be disappointed." Junebug987, thanks. An RVA pastor wrote, "Insightful, clever, and honest. A refreshing new voice with something worth hearing." So RVA pastor, thanks. I'm speaking to you through a nice microphone given to me by Jimmy Haas of Queens, New York. Apparently, I got the details of his band's latest EP wrong on my last episode and plugged an old one from a few years ago. His band, Mr. Eyeball's new EP, will be out on July 20th. It's called Mega Wet. Not Mega Watt, but Mega Wet. Look for it on iTunes and Spotify. Mega Wet. That sounds gross.
A haiku from your priest, poet, and friend, Father Aaron. Give yourselves some space and time to take a deep breath. Walls stop closing in.
This podcast is sponsored by Jonah Nightingale's Self-Storage Ministry. Now that churches across the country have had to leave their buildings empty due to that demonic Chinese virus, which is really a deep state conspiracy, your church may be reassessing whether or not you need such a big building anyway. Why have a building full of Sunday school classrooms that only get used once a week? You don't need that space when your small group ministry can just meet by Zoom. Think how much it costs to heat, cool, and maintain your building when you barely use it at all. Jonah Nightingale Ministries, known for its various divinely inspired works, such as the inflatable pulpit, the Holy Spirit healing gel, and Red Apron pre-prepared meals. It's red because it's sanctified by the blood of Christ. Brings you their latest holy humdinger, Jonah Nightingale's Self-Storage Ministry. Convert your empty church building into a self-storage unit. Did you know one of the fastest growing businesses in America is the self-storage industry? With baby boomers downsizing and their children not wanting mom and dad's junk, what are God-fearing members of a capitalist economy supposed to do? Own less stuff? I don't think so. They will put it all into a self-storage unit until they die, and then it will lay there forgotten until a reality TV series reveals it. Don't miss this chance to fund your church by turning your building into a moneymaker. We will happily show you how to do it for a reasonable fee, 80% of gross proceeds, and your church keeps the rest. But you're probably wondering what you should do with all that stuff currently in your building. What should you do with all your folding tables, chairs, dry erase boards, overhead projectors, boxes, and boxes of old Bibles that are too ratty to use but you can't get rid of them because it's the Bible, for God's sakes, along with the props from vacation Bible schools past, your unused church library, tons of vases left by the weekly florist delivery of altar flowers, those Bible maps and wall charts, and so much more. Should you sell it? Throw it out? I don't think so. You store it in Jonah Nightingale's Self-Storage Ministry. We will even give your church a discounted rate, and you won't have to move it far, because your unit will be in your own building. 80% of gross proceed rule still applies. Turn your unused church building into a moneymaker today with Jonah Nightingale Self-Storage Ministry. Thank you.
Jones versus Nixon. People say that when God closes a door, he opens a window. I don't say that, but people do. I will say when God closes a church, she opens a chance to cash in. Seizing this chance is the church specialist realtor. I know because one mailed us, unprompted, offering to sell our church. The realtor's name was Mr. Rose. Rose loves churches, this I know, for his bio tells me so. Little ones to him belong, they are weak, but he sells strong. Why did a realtor mail us, we wondered. Did he know something we didn't know? I emailed Rose, asking if Jim should be looking for work. He replied, "No, sister, all I know is Jesus is Lord." "Please, you know plenty, Mr. Rose. According to your bio, you hold information sessions for your growing or downsizing church." I don't know of any growing churches, but I do know some that are now tea rooms or antique malls. Your bio states that you help churches accomplish their real estate goals for God's glory. I guess God glories in dovetailed pie safes in Quiche, Lorraine. Along with his letter, Rose sent us his business card. I put it on our fridge to remind us that if Jim loses his job, we can't buy food. When I look at that magnet, I wonder about the members of all the churches sold. Do they miss their church? Are they sad? Relieved? Do they keep up with their friends? Go out now for Sunday brunch? Did Rose sign their emails, "Stay blessed," like he did mine? Unfortunately for Mr. Rose, our church is still alive. He'll earn no great commission just yet. In the other corner, opposing Rose, is our church consultant, Nixon. Mr. Nixon founded Epicenter Group, which provides coaching in the midst of cultural change. Finally, someone besides God on our side. According to its website, Epicenter coaches leaders to discern ways forward for relevant, community-based Christianity and to birth the new things God is up to in this world. That right there is how you sweet-talk a minister. So we hired Nixon, the great physician, to help us birth new things, things besides a weekly service, new ways to connect with God. Reinvention is freeing and a lot of pressure. It's on us. Lord, hear our prayer. There were surveys, formulas, questionnaires, demographics, committees formed. There were Skyped conversations, brainstorming sessions, budget talks, a retreat. There were books assigned, and some of them Jim read. Will our work pay off? Hashtag Nixon for the win. Or will we, poof, turn into a tea room? Hashtag smelling like a rose. God only knows. So for now, we labor. We keep the faith and that blessed realtor at bay.
I look at the ministry you've had at Circular Church in Charleston, and I will cop to real jealousy. That's the sort of ministry I always hoped I would have. To me, you show up in this conservative state, and you step into this progressive church. It's like there were so many people who were dying of thirst for a progressive form of Christianity. I've just seen, from a distance, your ministry grow there. You're writing for Charleston's Alt Weekly. You're known in the community, and you've done all this racial justice work. How do you explain, in such a conservative area, that your progressive church is thriving?
The first thing I really need to say is that so many people did so much to make Circular Church what it is. When the search committee invited me to become the minister, I'll never forget this, Chase. They said, we'd like you to become our 38th settled minister. So we've got a long history, and there was an ethos here that's been developed over time. And the church has a long history of activism and of social conscience, and has had really wonderful ministers before me, including my predecessor, who was here for, I think, 34 years and was extraordinary and still is. So there's a lot of love between the present and the past. You know, there's this really wonderful continuity. This church is almost 3.5 centuries old. I just showed up. 8 years is nothing. We have this long history. I just feel like we're the current embodiment of that story. So I really want to say that first, because it's beautiful. I've asked myself so many times, how was this church like this? Where did this ethos come from? This kindness, this compassion, this committedness to work for justice, this inclusive spirit. All that was here when I got here. I was just so happy about it. And I was, as you know, I showed up here when I was 40, but there had been a time when I didn't think I would live to be 40. I was so happy to be alive and to be doing good work.
But it's remarkable to hear that, because I'm literally making a podcast where I'm making fun of and trying to draw attention to the death of the mainline church.
Right.
Right. In my opinion, American Christianity, in so many ways, is dying, and that's a good thing. I think it needs to die, so something else can be reborn. But Circular hasn't followed the mainline decline. You know, it's an outlier, dying mainline churches. And it's got the big, expensive, old building in a downtown, right? I mean, it's got a long history. It's got all the makings of a declining, dying mainline church. But it's not. It's quite the opposite. Why?
Right. That's the question. Well, I think it also has the makings of something really wonderful, in that a couple of things come to mind. I think so much of the church is dying, the institutional church, and I think a lot of it probably should die or is not healthy enough to live. But in a church, at least in American terms, that is as old as our church is, because we were founded in 1681, we've constantly adapted. So the idea of change is built in. We talk with our confirmation class, with our youth and kids. We talk about the idea that this church was once made of people who literally owned other people as property. And then they came to conscience about that, and they became abolitionists. There was a time when we did not ordain women in our church because it's so old. And then we came to conscience about that, and we did. And the list goes on. There was a time when we accepted segregation as a way of life here, and then we came to conscience and we joined the civil rights struggle. Again, on and on the list goes, but the church has constantly adapted and changed. And that's ethically, we've grown. It's a little humbling, because it helps us to realize that there are things we're getting really wrong right now, and we're not aware of them. I think our conscience continues on its journey. I think it will still develop. But in a church this old, that's the ethical piece, the theological piece, but we've also, there have been fires, there have been more than one war, there have been earthquakes, there have been pandemics. So there's this idea that we weather things and then we adapt and change and then we carry on. Something about that, I think, helps us. And also just some nuts and bolts stuff. Charleston is really growing. People are moving in. There's a lot of very conservative religion here. There's not very much progressive religion, a little more than when I got here 8 years ago, but still not a lot. And so people are moving in, they're coming from bigger cities, and they're expecting a church that will march in the Pride Parade, or that will say Black Lives Matter, or that will care about climate change, or that will do the kinds of things that resonate and create the kind of community where they can be themselves and bring their families and raise their kids. In some ways, that's just basic stuff. When your town is growing and there's not much on offer that's progressive, then a few hundred people will find their way to you.
So, right.
You know, I don't want to make any of us sound like geniuses. Some of it's just, that's good fortune. And if our church was in a town that was losing population or that had many options, you know, that would be different. Also, the South still has a kind of church-going culture.
Sure.
And so the Deep South, where I am, so a lot of people kind of think maybe they should go to church on a Sunday. That might be a thing you do. We've got other family in other parts of the country where that's not part of the culture. It's Sunday, so that is a good day to go surfing or whatever. Right. You know, that's a good day
sure.
to hike. And those are also wonderful things. I'm not knocking those things, but I think culturally here, there's still a church thing going on. Probably helps us too.
That does make it easier that people actually think about going to church.
Right. Right.
And yeah, but that's still a value in some way. Makes it easier. You've been a good friend, Jeremy. You're inspirational to me in many ways.
Thanks.
You're part of what keeps me from being completely cynical about clergy and church. So that's a good thing, I think.
All of us who love the church and have worked in it or volunteered, given ourselves to it, probably have more stories of disappointment than wonderful stories. I don't know. Who's to say? I think when we find and create communities that really do reflect our values, it's just worth giving them all we have. And I really say that as the son of an anthropologist. I don't think my religious way is the only way of being. I don't think my tradition is the only tradition. You know me, I'm not homogenous. But I think within our tradition, we have these extraordinary cultural resources, stories, and symbols that really can be healing and really can shape people's moral and ethical imagination. If we do it well, we really can become better people and we can become better members of the group. That seems like a really good use of religion to me. At heart, I'm a pragmatist. I want to know what's the effect of this. If I go to church, am I becoming more compassionate? Am I working harder for justice? Am I becoming a little more whole as a human being? Might I be a better listener? Might I develop some reverence toward the earth? Or am I going to church? I'm becoming more judgmental. I'm becoming more egocentric. Those are my questions. And maybe that's the pain of religion for so many of us. We see a lot of communities forming people in ways that are judgmental and exclusive and mean-spirited, honestly, tribal. But there are other communities too where we see people becoming more compassionate, becoming more forgiving, becoming better, I think. That's the hope. I know some of what you've been through and some of what so many of our friends have been through and even things that I've been through that we didn't record. Can I end with a story? I've taken a lot of your time, but...
No, not at all. You're giving me lots of content here for my podcast, by all means. And I would say this as a preface to your story, which is everything you've just said that's so hopeful about church...
Mm-hmm.
I would not be listening to, I would not be open to if I didn't know you had also been in the valley of the darkest dark with churches in the past.
Right.
And I understand and respect why we didn't go into that in the podcast.
Sure.
But I would just say for you and for our listeners, you're not Pollyanna. You've experienced how bad churches can be and how good they can be. And I wouldn't be having you on my podcast if I didn't know that about you.
Right. And I think similar, Chase, our work for justice in the community and our work to make the church what we believe it ought to be and can be, in both cases, we're swimming against such a strong current. Work for racial justice in South Carolina, don't get your hopes up. You know, if you work to make the church really compassionate and inclusive, it's not always going to work. And I'm speaking broadly, but then we find these other people and we start to create things and push things. And that's really where I put my energy. And I just think of the church that my son is growing up in. And I compare it to the church that my grandmother grew up in. I think this would have been about 12 years ago, give or take. That I was diagnosed, well, I was having some problems with my fingers. I didn't know what was happening and they were going numb. And then I started to have some problems breathing, some difficulty. And I found my way to a rheumatologist who began to watch my symptoms. And it turned out she was an expert in the disease that I was diagnosed with, which is called scleroderma. It causes your tissue to harden. It's it's an autoimmune disease, and so it causes your tissue to try to repair something that's not wrong. You overproduce collagen, thicken your tissue, and that can be really bad. Scleroderma patients, it can affect any organ system. So I have friends whose heart tissue is affected, or friends whose GI tract is affected, things like that. With me, it affects my lungs, which is really a problem. You don't want your lung tissue to thicken, to scar, to become fibrotic. And that's what was happening with me. And so I did a fairly intensive therapy. I'm really grateful that I had the doctors I had and they could intervene quickly. I did about a year of a medicine that's usually used for leukemia. So I got a dose of what chemotherapy is like. It's hard to describe what it's like to be in your 30s and really not be able to breathe very well, have that getting worse by the day. We were able to get that to stabilize. Then we were able to transition me to a medication that really works for me. Over time, that leukemia drug was really going to be too toxic to take for a long time. I was part of some clinical trials that determined a new standard of care and had really wonderful researchers in Houston. And now I've been really stable for a long time, and I'm kind of a poster boy for how treatment can go. I'm really very fortunate. But having said that, I still live with lung disease. I have scarred lungs, and I take an immunosuppressive medication to keep the scarring from continuing, which just means I'm susceptible to catching everything. So I have to live very carefully for that reason. I don't have to stay at home, or at least not until this pandemic. I was out and about doing everything everybody else does, but I was already washing my hands a lot. I was already really mindful, you know, of germs and colds, and certainly whenever pneumonia was around, I was aware of that. So this particular pandemic is especially worrisome for me, and I think for people like me. So that one of my friends who's a doctor, as soon as the pandemic came to South Carolina, he told me, and I think this is almost an exact quote, he said, "You're the perfect target for this. You've got to get out of here." And he meant I should go. He was talking to me at church. So he meant I've got to get out of public for a while. And so I've been staying at home during the pandemic. That the church where I work in Charleston has been wonderful. And certainly everybody understands, and we've all been staying at home. But that's me. I'm one of the more vulnerable people, although there are an awful lot of us out there. So.
And I recall you telling me that if school starts back up in September and your wife, Sarah, is a teacher and your son goes back to school, that you would have to live separate from your family. Are you still thinking that's what could happen?
Yeah, I think that is something that may happen. So we are careful to follow the science and we just go where it takes us. If my family are back in school every day, and they're exposed to whatever's in the community, and they bring it home to me. Again, my doctors are really worried about how I would do if I contracted the virus. And nobody really likes my chances. So we have to do everything we can to prevent me from getting it, although we want to be careful. I don't really want my family to get it either. I don't want anybody to get it. We may need to physically distance from each other if they're in school every day so that I can be protected from that exposure. Thankfully, we have a dear friend who offered my family a place to be that is very close to our home. So we're already imagining, can we walk to the park and meet each other for dinner at a safe distance? How can we be a family and take care of each other? And so many people have been through illness or been through different experiences like this. I also think of frontline workers right now. I have friends, you know, one spouse works in the ER and they're already keeping a distance from each other, or they're made different portions of their home, kind of sealed them off from other portions. So there are a lot of people already living this story and trying to figure out how to take care of each other without exposing each other. And if it comes to that, it will be very painful for us. And it's also something that we can do to take care of each other. And I'm thinking of people who are already doing it and really struggling. So it's hard for me to understand why we wouldn't all do everything we can for public health, and why we wouldn't keep a physical distance, and why we wouldn't wear masks, and why we wouldn't wash our hands, and why we wouldn't just be kind and treat others with care. It's hard where I live because I see so many people really close together, not keeping a distance, not wearing masks, acting as if everything is normal and something has changed when nothing has changed. And in fact, in South Carolina at the moment, our infection rates are increasing. we're trending upward and we've now opened everything. And to me, I just think it's really important just to follow the science and act accordingly. I think that's what our family will do. That's certainly what our church is doing. And we'll figure out creative ways to be family, creative ways to be church, and take care of each other at the same time. So ask me later how it's going, you know, but I think we can do it.
Coming around to anger again, you're looking and having to physically separate your family, live in separate places so you don't die.
Right.
All right. It's not like you and your wife are glad to be apart. The two of you dearly love each other and dearly love your son. This is painful. And yet you're in freaking South Carolina. I mean, look at who are your senators. My God, it's insane. Do you just feel angry like every day about the insanity of the response to the coronavirus? I do, and I don't have an autoimmune disease. How do you manage your anger about it?
I don't know. I do feel angry. It comes and goes. I mean, at the moment, I'm much angrier about the way Black people are treated every day. But it's really just, it's an indifference to suffering that makes me so angry. And so many of our politicians here in South Carolina are indifferent to suffering, certainly indifferent to Black suffering, but indifferent to the suffering of everyone who doesn't have health care. We still haven't expanded Medicaid and we can't get it through. So our governor and our legislature won't do it, even during a time of pandemic. We have, I think, over 20% of South Carolinians are uninsured and they won't act to help. We don't have a living wage here. We don't have good public transportation here. You know, there's so many things. The educational system is so unequal in terms of race. There's so many things to be angry about in South Carolina because there's such indifference to suffering on the part of our leaders and on the part of so many who have the power to make real change. I'm not any angrier that it's happening to me than I am that it's been happening to so many for so long. You know, I'm not special. I'm just one among many who my senators don't really care about. And I remember once I went as part of a lobbying day to D.C. and we were lobbying. We were all scleroderma patients lobbying for NIH money just to continue the funding of our medical university here. They're doing amazing research on fibrosis and lung tissue and others could help so many people. It's really something that we're all proud of here in Charleston. I went to my representative's office and spoke with the staff. Three or four of us told our stories of living with this disease and our families and the effects it had on us and why we were asking for continued funding. I need to tell you, Chase, that one of the people who spoke was the young daughter of one of my friends. And she told the story of her mom and what it was like to see her suffer. And she was tearful and it was heartfelt. You know, this young girl telling this story. And at the end of it, the staffer said, well, how much will it cost? You know, and they weren't in support of it because of the money. And so that's South Carolina. We have a lot of really good people here. We don't always have good representation here.
That would have helped the university hospital there. That would have helped jobs there.
Right.
I mean, even if you aren't going to care about the scleroderma patient, that would have been good for the economy. And they still didn't care.
Right. You can even be indifferent to human suffering and still make an economic case.
Yes.
For people like us, or I think just for people with an ethic, I don't think it has to be about money. You can make the case that we should care about each other because we need to have value and dignity.
Sure.
Because everyone deserves care because we love each other.
Right.
But again, that would require knowing each other, being in relationship. I worry that too many of our public officials are just in relationship with their donors. And we weren't giving them money. We were there actually to ask for support.
Right.
I don't feel completely cynical about that, but I also feel very angry about it. You know, I think that's a fair critique that my wife thinks, Sarah thinks that we should judge our elected officials based on measurable outcomes like life expectancy in their district. You know,
right.
Quality of living, happiness index. How are you doing? Are you people happy, healthy, well? How's everything? Based on those metrics, I don't know if we would reelect anybody in this state. Although, in fairness, we have a few good ones. So I don't want to throw everybody under the bus, but there are some really wonderful public officials that we have. And I have seen through our justice work some people who were indifferent in positions of power and some people who really cared and had an ethic in those same positions of power. And it's extraordinary how much change can happen and how quickly it can come when the right person is in the right place and when they care. That keeps me from being cynical, because I think just because there are a lot of the wrong people in those positions doesn't mean it has to be that way.